Hey everybody, I'm Dan from Portland, Oregon.
I'm Kate from Minneapolis.
I'm Zach from Madison, Wisconsin.
The Sound of Young America is an independent production
supported by listeners like me.
If you'd like to donate to support the show,
visit MaximumFun.org
and please click on donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne, live on tape from my house in Los Angeles. It's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the program is Kevin Klein. He's one of the stars of the film The Extra Man, which has just premiered here at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. He's also won most of the awards you can win for being an actor. He's one of the few people who has won an Oscar for a comic role. He does not yet have a Cable Ace Award, but I think that may be in his future. He may even get one retroactively for one of his films running on cable. In The Extra Man, he plays an eccentric and delightful older gentleman who lives in spectacularly beautiful squalor in a walk-up in New York City. Kevin, welcome to The Sound of Young America.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
When I was reading about your life growing up, I read a passing mention of the fact that your father owned a record store, which later became a candy and record store.
No, toy.
Toy and record store.
Yeah. No, I still have my teeth.
You're the appropriate age where he opened the record store in the early 40s before you were born, but you're of the appropriate age where like record store is like the single coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
The record explosion that happened in the 1950s was, you know, your childhood, and then the rock and roll music becoming the, you know, incredible countercultural force is your like adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like to have a dad that owned a record store during that time?
It was very interesting because my father was he had actually studied to be an opera singer, and was a great lover of music, and he liked jazz and popular music. But I grew up with opera and a lot of symphonic music and whatever, chamber music, always sort of going in the house every Saturday with the opera would be broadcast from the Met and that would be blaring out from the radio. And so what was funny is that I played in a rock and roll band. I also was studying classical piano. But my father was – and he liked the Beatles. He thought this was – but he wasn't crazy about rock and roll. And it was funny because I still meet people on the streets of New York saying, you know, I used to go into your father's store and your father introduced me to classical music and he weaned me away from rock and roll. He would sort of he didn't mind that people liked rock and roll, but he wanted to introduce them to good music. So he was always sort of holding forth and say, well, listen to this. But he had a great musical ear. People would call him and say, I heard something on the radio, and they could just hum a little snatch or say, oh, yes, that's the Mozart G minor second movement, measure 226.
Did it make it difficult to be a rebellious teenager in a rock and roll band when your dad was okay with it?
I was rebellious in an insidious kind of passive-aggressive quiet way, mostly in school, and I guess with my parents, I tended to use humor as a weapon, which got me in a lot of trouble in school on a fairly daily basis. But it was a thing about authority, something I've thought about because I sort of do the same thing with certain directors I work with. Well, who made the teacher boss? Why does he get to make all of the sort of authoritative choices here? Why is the director? We're all here together. Let's work this out.
What kind of insidious passive aggressive activities were you getting into that were getting you in trouble on a daily basis?
I was a wise cracking in class, and I went to a very strict school run by Benedictine monks from Ampleforth Abbey in York, and so it was sort of like an English school where we wore ties and coats, and, you know, jackets and had to stand up when the master came in the room, and there was corporal punishment, things like that. And we thought that was cool because it was different. But it's like making a joke in church. It's easier in a way. It's a cheaper joke. But when you have a very strict teacher who's demanding absolute silence and whatever, and you just kind of break the silence with asking an inane question.
When did you decide that you were absolutely positively going to be an actor? And what kind of actor did you imagine yourself to be when you decided that?
Well, it's only recently that I think I've finally settled into it. No, but
you
for
always
years,
wanted to be an opera singer. If
no,
I'm
no,
not mistaken.
I did want to be. I went to college to study music, and ended up in theater. But being a musician first, an aspiring musician, you know, one didn't call oneself a musician unless you achieved a degree of musicianship. You know, that was the highest compliment. Said, "Now that you know, he's or she's a real musician. Listen to her play." So then when I became an actor, when people say, oh, you're an actor, I said, well, I'm an aspiring actor. I was sort of, I thought, well, I know you don't call yourself an actor until there's some degree of mastery. So it was probably about when I started doing Broadway, I thought, I guess, when other people hired me other than the acting company, which is where I started, John Houseman was the director of the Juilliard School, and I was in the first graduating class, and he didn't want us to go off and do television and movies. So he said, I'm going to keep you all together as a company and we're going to tour the country and do the classics. And this was great training. I spent 4 years doing that.
There's a company that still exists.
Oh, yes. Yes. And flourishing. And my point being what? That training, I think, even though because it came out of the school, I still wasn't sure. I said, well, I got lucky. I happened to be in the right class at the right time. So it wasn't
you
until I started getting...
happened to be in Juilliard.
Well, yeah. Yeah. That's true, which I thought, well, there must be some mistake, but I'll go with it. So I wasn't sure until I really got hired a few times by people that sort of didn't have to hire me that I thought, maybe there's something in this.
When you switched your ambition from musician to actor, and I imagine that you had to have a reasonably focused ambition to apply to and be accepted to Juilliard, probably the most prestigious acting school in the country. Did you imagine yourself like, treading the boards, performing the works of the bard? Or do you imagine yourself singing the Pirates of Penzance? Or
never.
Or being never. The next Don Knotts?
A little of each and none of the above. No, it was it wasn't an aspiration or an ambition. It was an obsession. It was my life. I just had to act. So... I think Juilliard helped, but I went to Juilliard to become a classical actor because it was this brand new school and they were focusing on style and classics and you know the Western, you know the great works of the Western canon, and I said yeah that's the stuff I like that stuff, that was my focus, and I guess I thought yeah for a while I thought I would be just a theater actor, and then when I started working in the theater and. I thought, well, this seems to be my niche, and the films are not. No one's calling. Just come to Hollywood and be in movies. No one did that, so I thought, okay, this is it. And it was actually Pirates of Penzance, which I agreed to do because, well, just be 4 weeks in Central Park, outdoors, and I'd never heard Gilbert and Sullivan until I played the score, and it made me laugh, and I thought the music was beautiful. I thought, well, how bad can this be? But then a year's run on Broadway and then a film and all that. It was not what I set out to do. But because of it, Joe Papp, the producer, said, you know, you've really got the right instrument for, you should be doing Shakespeare. I said, well, Joe, in fact, that's why I'm here. That's what I really want to do. I did not set out to do Gilbert and Sullivan, which I always... sort of thought of that scene in the Woody Allen film Bananas where they're torturing a guy and trying to get him to confess to her, yeah. Just you know, give him some information, but he's tied to a chair and they're forcing him to listen to Gilbert and Sullivan. That was my association with it. The more Shakespeare so he gave me Richard III to cut my teeth on, and and I had a wonderful time, and then that led to more Shakespeare. Joe was wonderful because he would come. backstage opening night or after the first preview. Okay, so what are we going to do next? How about, you know, Much Ado About Nothing next summer? Okay. And he would exact a commitment. And it was very paternal, and it was, of course, nice to feel wanted. But I always had that, which kind of kept me in the theater a lot. And also gave me a place to go back to the theater when I started doing film, which was right after Pirates of Penzance.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the actor Kevin Kline. We spoke at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City after the premiere of his new film, The Extra Man. One of his first film roles was in the musical comedy The Pirates of Penzance. In this scene, Kline, as the pirate king, is bidding farewell to a crew member.
Frederick! Don't swim. Take the dinghy! And when your process of extermination begins, let our deaths be as swift and painless as you can conveniently make them.
I will. By the love I have for you, I swear it. Oh, would that you could render this extermination unnecessary by accompanying me back to civilization.
No, Frederick. It cannot be. I don't think much of our profession, but contrasted with respectability, it is comparatively honest. No, Frederick. I shall live and die a pirate king!
Pirates of Penzance was adapted into a film in which you were also featured in the early 80s. That I think was the first one that you made. The first one that came out was Sophie's Choice.
Right.
Which was another acclaimed role. Was it difficult or scary at all at the age of, you know, you were already in your mid-30s by the time you started doing this stuff.
Mm.
Was it difficult or scary to do this whole new kind of thing? Stage acting and film acting are very different.
Well, that's what I went into my first two movies. I mean, I always discount Pirates of Penzance because we basically filmed the production. In fact, the director who had directed us on stage, he said, this is theater. This, do exactly what you did. Don't. In fact, I had to go right from that. The day after we wrapped that, I went into Sophie's Choice, and he kept saying, save the acting for Sophie's Choice. I want performance, you know. And so we just, it wasn't really like making a movie. Sophie's Choice was like what I thought was making a movie, shooting out of sequence, no rehearsal, all those
things like
cameras sticking in your face, all that, you know.
Just sometimes performing without the other person that you're performing in a scene with there, or having them on the other side of a camera or something like that. Those are things that can be incredibly difficult,
yeah,
for an actor.
Yeah. Luckily, when I left the acting company 4 years after finishing Juilliard, I vowed, of course, I'll never do a commercial and I'll never do a soap opera. And, you know, that's how you develop bad habits, blah, blah, blah. And I did a couple of commercials and a soap opera because I was starving. That sounds a little more dramatic than it should. The soap opera, really, I learned a lot. I just did a year. I just played a little recurring role that showed up occasionally. But I got used to having, you know, three cameras pointed at me. I got used to improvising. And I learned a lot about writing because we rewrote everything. The actors, you know, early on, oh, no, you have to say what's written. Just, you know, do it. And so I would learned a lot that has continued to help me in the film.
I've heard from actory friends that one of the things about a soap opera is that you just kind of have to do it. Like there's no
sort of
you don't get to there's no very little preparation.
Oh my God.
You're just sort of like thrown into everything. You just kind of have to learn to just go to town.
And it's for the most part just wretched material. I mean, highly expositional. You can't say, hi, Joe. It has to be, hi, Joe, how are you? I haven't seen you since the pregnancy and the plane crash and your uncle's death. Because in case someone missed the last week, you have to update them. So it's not how people talk. It's like Gilbert. It's as stylized in this way as Gilbert and Sullivan. And those are kind of things where you say something, you say, well, I'm not going. And the camera just lingers on you. And they do the stinger, that on the organ. And you know, I'd like to say some more, but The camera just lingers on you.
I like to imagine
got egg all over your face, and that's part of the style.
Just off stage.
That's how. Listen, in the radio days, one of the actors on the soap I did, Search for Tomorrow, had been there since the early days of radio and live television. He told great stories how they had rehearsed a phone ringing, for example, and he got used to just miming the phone and picking up. Yes, hello. And then, of course, they're rolling. It's live, and he does this. Hello. And realizes there's no phone in his hand and had to kind of wing it from there. But yes,
it's sort of you're thrown into it.
It's sink or swim.
It's interesting to me, too, that your first two major film roles were already so spectacularly divergent.
I was very lucky that
it would be difficult to make two more different kinds of films than Sophie's Choice in a film version of The Pirates of Penzance.
It's funny, if I may interrupt,
sure.
Because it was seeing me in Pirates of Penzance that the director of Sophie's Choice, Alan Pakula, he saw that and cast me. And I said, you saw Pirates of Penzance and you want me to play this role?
Okay. And he said, you are the very model of a modern major general.
No, he said there was just something in the outrageousness of the pirate king that he preferred for the character of Nathan. Rather than a brooding, all internalized, he was out there, that character, and very exuberant. The real lucky thing for me was then doing The Big Chill, which was playing this normal guy after playing this wacko, and I think that kind of helped break. I thought, oh God, if I just don't want to play crazies all my film career, and that kind of put a stop to that.
It must have been really something to be in The Big Chill and not just be like a normal guy, but the Big Chill, is sort of like there are so few parallels, but maybe Reality Bites might be half a parallel. But this kind of generationally defining movie where all of a sudden you are the representative for everyone that is roughly your age.
Well, yes, but we did not know that while we were making it. It was a lovely script and unusual and interesting, and we rehearsed for 4 weeks, which is unheard of in a film. Just rehearsing, so that in the body language there was this familiarity among us and between us, kind of all over us actually. It was just fun to do.
That's what's great about the outdoors, it's one giant toilet.
Maybe you should put a spot like this in your club.
This thing's going to be big, Harold. You should take it more seriously. You'd have your own table waiting at all times.
I'm considering the investment. I've always wanted my own table.
Right.
Now, I'd have a chair, too, right?
It's The Sound of Young America from PRI, Public Radio International.
Production of The Sound of Young America is underwritten in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com.
Max FunCon is MaximumFun.org's annual convocation of things that are awesome. You can join me and dozens of great teachers and performers for a weekend in a retired hunting lodge in the woods this May here in Southern California. We'll have comedy from Mark Maron, Al Madrigal, Maria Bamford, Jimmy Pardo, Casper Hauser, Elephant Larry, and more. Plus talks from author and comic John Hodgman, rocker Andrew W.K., and Radiolab's Jad Abumrad, among others. And classes on everything from crafting to improv to the art of the cocktail. For more information on Max FunCon, visit maxfuncon.com. That's maxfuncon.com. But remember that slots fill up fast. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Kevin Kline. We spoke at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah, after the premiere of his new film, The Extra Man. He's one of a select few actors who won an Oscar for a comedic role. It was for his work in A Fish Called Wanda. Here he is in an early scene from that movie. He's posing as Jamie Lee Curtis's brother as she introduces him to a stuttering character tending to some fish, played by Michael Palin.
Hi, Ken.
Hello, Wanda.
Ken, this is Otto.
Hello, Ken. Wanda's told me a lot about you. Hey, great fish.
Oh,
a little squeeze of lemon, some tartar sauce, perfect.
George back yet?
No, he had to go to the...
What? Oh, that's quite a stutter you've got there, Ken. It's all right. It doesn't bother me. George needs a weapons man, eh?
A cup of tea, Ken?
Yeah, he'd like one. I had a good friend in the CIA had a stutter. Cost him his life, damn it.
Some of your biggest successes were in relatively broad comedy. I mean, certainly, you know, you had that rare distinction of having won an Oscar for playing a really like a broad comic part, which is an amazing distinction, a really funny, like crazy thing. Was it a goal of yours to get to do that, to get to bring all this acting skill that you had to bear onto something that was less quote unquote serious, or was it happenstance that you ended up being this, you know, your biggest star moments have been in kind of happy comedies.
Hmm. Yes. Yeah, I had done comedies, broad comedies, restoration comedies, Shakespearean comedies, contemporary comedies, farces on stage. But having done Sophie's Choice and then The Big Chill, people thought of me as I was always reading about this serious actor because I was a trained actor and all that, and I did Shakespeare. But it was great fun to do so. Fish Called Wanda, and then offers suddenly Hollywood thought of me as a comic actor as well as the other stuff. So that was a nice thing, but it was something that I'd been doing, but just not on film. And again, didn't know while I was making it that it would be popular or anything. In fact, I had a couple of friends who said, "You're gonna go work with the Pythons? I mean, that's so English." I said, "I don't care. I'm working with two of the Michael Palin and John Cleese are two of the greatest comedians of this century, and I'm going." And it was a thrill. But in fact, it was and John Cleese, the first day I just started doing this stuff, and I said, "It's too big, right?" He said, "No, bigger, go, go, go." He wrote the part for me, having done a little part in Silverado, this Western that we were in together. He in rehearsals, he saw me doing that thing that I was talking about when I was in high school, sort of clowning around. And he then knew that there was a latent kind of clown there that he wanted to draw out.
But one of the things about that role that I was thinking about after I saw The Extra Man last night was the significance of being able to do something that is big, that is also sincere and grounded.
That's the key.
How do you approach that challenge? Because I mean, comedy is often almost like a technical exercise. It's just like clowning is about performing a routine super ably. Mm-hmm. You know, you there are certain skills to getting a laugh, and often actors want to, you know, when they're quote unquote being serious, want everything to be profoundly organic, mm-hmm. which is different from, say, for example, doing a funny voice. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think that's part of the challenge. I mean, comedy is binary in a way; it's either funny or it isn't. Whereas drama, you can. It's a pretty serious thing, but you kind of it either works or it doesn't. It's lightning in a bottle. It's all those cliches, but it's really the same thing. I think it's the same challenge, which is to make whether it's Oedipus Rex or Hamlet or broad comedy. It's however big or whatever style it is, you have to make it as real, as human, as recognizably human as possible. So I think you're right that comedy has – it seems technical because there are more, I think, readily observable conventions. It's from vaudeville. We know there's certain things you do that are just funny. But I've seen those things done that are not funny because they're replications of what comedy is supposed to look like or sound like. But the real challenge doing comedy is the same as doing tragedy. Drama.
When you throughout your career have moved between the theater and film and almost never television, but the theater and film and all these different sorts of roles, what are the qualities in something that say like, yeah, I'm going to spend months of my time doing this?
Good question. it's something different, something original, something that will stretch one as an actor, as we say, or not stretch one at all, contract one. But you know, it's stuff that made you laugh and that you sort of hear in your head and you feel like, yeah, I get this and I know how to make this work. And it's funny and it's well observed and it's real and it's unique, one hopes.
You just did, if I'm not mistaken, based on a newspaper article from Montreal that I read, you recently did a film in French.
Yeah, and that was for
so
that
that's
reason.
Pretty different.
Yeah, it was wonderfully different. It was like going back to square one in a way, because I mean, aside from working in France within this whole other a cultural divide that was fascinating to see how they work, how a French crew works, and how French... I'd always been intrigued about French acting. There's something so minimalist about most of it, and they just sort of are behaving.
From watching My Stepfather, the Hero, starring Gerard Depardieu.
You know, I missed that, but I heard... But that was a foray into
a minimalist masterpiece.
Was he minimal? Oh, I was like trying to be as minimal as
his
possible.
His mastery of English was minimal.
Well... Yes, there is that, and probably people's reaction to the French film may be like it's like what is he saying? I can't understand. But I played an American who's lived in France for 25 years and speaks fluent French. Very challenging, but wonderful experience working with Sandrine Bonnaire, who's one of my favorite actresses and one of the great minimalists. She just is, you go, wow, it's so. So small, so there's no, and I realized in the process, American actors, we sort of want to, every scene has to have a beginning, middle, and end, and we want to make a point, and we want to emote, and all those horrible things, and the French are, just behave, I'm just here, it's like, the world is just, blown up, or whatever, and go up. It's all internal, so the audience can then imagine. There's also, they're speaking another language. We don't know what the hell they're saying. We're reading the bottom printout on the screen, and wow, they're just amazing. They're different. It was unique. So, and when that came along, I grabbed it because here's something different.
It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Kevin Kline. We spoke at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah, after the premiere of his new film, The Extra Man, which is adapted from a novel by Jonathan Ames. Let's talk for a second about The Extra Man, which just premiered here at Sundance. It's an adaptation of a Jonathan Ames novel about a young man with sort of literary or writerly ambitions who moves to New York City, quote unquote, to find himself and moves in with an older gentleman who literally puts an ad in the newspaper that says gentleman looking for same. To share a house, you play the resident of that house. Describe your character a little bit, because I feel like I would ruin it.
No, I would ruin it too, and certainly minimalize it. I hate describing a character because people are going to see it and take away different things. If I say, well, he's this and this and this, the fact that the character exists in a book, a hysterical book that I highly recommend. It's really laugh out loud funny on just about every page. And the things that my character, Henry Harrison, says in the book and in the film are so insanely witty and from left field and contradictory and just there's a wonderful outrageousness about the character.
There was a moment that I was talking about with Ben and Nick, who are the crew that are here with me at Sundance, where Paul Dano's character, the young gentleman, is describing his profound emotional connection to his car, which had belonged to his father who died when he was in college.
Yes.
And your character kind of listens carefully and pauses for a moment, and then with a flourish of the hand says, Well, I drive a Buick.
Yeah.
He's the sort of guy who looks very at home in a bow tie and like a silk dressing gown or a dinner jacket.
I think it's panache. You know, one has to have. I mean, he describes himself as having being so popular among the rich
because of his distinctive joie de vivre.
Joie de vivre, exactly. And wit. It reminded me of Falstaff in terms of this guy who also prides himself on his wit. I'm not only witty to myself, but I'm a sort. What is it? Something of wit in other men. Falstaff prides himself, and he's certainly arguably the most witty character in dramatic literature. But in the same way, I think Henry Harrison is. It's about being brilliant, and brilliant in your utterance of however you express your. However insane his ideas are,
it's an interesting contrast between his incredible skill at being an outrageous, charming, delightful person, and the desperation that's built into the character. Exactly. Because he's his lifestyle is built around being the titular extra man, which is to say, he's a guy who is charming to ladies that are much richer than he is, and so they keep him hanging around. He's basically a professional, like, entourage member. Like, if it wasn't rich ladies and it was rappers, he would be what they call the weed carrier, the guy who holds the weed in case they get arrested.
The weed carrier, right. Yeah, it's to be relegated to extra man status is and yet he has a kind of pride. I mean, he's not bitter about his of course, he's very, very bitter, but the fact that he presses on, that he's resilient, that he's found a niche, and is so doggedly attached to it, and desperate. There's something sort of Ratso Rizzo about this guy who's just living from one meal to the next, living in squalor, and yet had this idea about style and panache and wit and pressing on, always pressing on, no matter what, you know, and all these terrible things happen. But he's got this wonderful survival mechanism and wit. And the idea that someone who could be in such dire straits financially and yet feel, well arrogant, he's arrogant, but certainly feels proud of his intelligence. That is what makes one a success. If you can have a bon mot or a brilliant conversation, or feel strongly about something and express it succinctly, that's success. And that's kind of an old, it's sort of quixotic in its way about, it's an old set of values, which then the young Paul Dano character is drawn to. It's an interesting character.
Do you think that he's, I would say, comfortable in that set of values, or do you think he's burdened by the sort of other thing that's going on for him, which is that he's unable to provide for himself as an artist, as a playwright, which seems to be, you know, his other great passion?
Yes, and the real man that in Jonathan Ames' life that this is based on was a playwright. Who was now writing? He would adapt from literary figures' letters, and he'd do an evening of George Eliot's letters to the man that she lived with, who became her husband, whose name escapes me, or you know, the Browning's correspondence, or things like that. But make it into a theatrical evening, and he toured the country with these things. But of course, I'm sure you know he felt that he did write a masterpiece, and it was stolen and. There's a bitterness, but there's also what's great is that he persists in a level of unreality, a sense that there is a performance. Life is performing for him, and he is a man of the theater. And I love that line about, well, he's, you know, there's a rumor he's homosexual. Well, he's probably, you've got to be a little homosexual. Because he's
that way
the
you
theater.
Can feel more. So theater people need it so they can feel
so
more
they can
deeply.
Feel more deeply. They become a little homosexual so they can feel more deeply. And I think he does feel things deeply, although he's very guarded. You know, in the beginning he says, is this a conversation? Well, this has to stop. I don't want to know about you, and I don't want you to know about me. There's a mask that he wears that he needs in order to survive, not only because just to get through the pain of this subsistence level life, but in the highest echelon of, you know, with all the wealthiest people, it's like the prince and the pauper. It's this odd placement of people. And
it looked like it was really fun.
It was fun. It was very, when you say, how do you pick a film that you want to devote 3 months of your life to? It was 5 weeks all in. And that was a very short schedule. Which is good, though. A lot of times, many, many good things happen from feeling rushed when you don't have the luxury of, oh, we can just do 100 takes and, well, let's try it this way, let's try it that way, and, well, we can shoot it this way and cover it. You don't have, no, this is shoot it, move on.
The scene where
I was painting my ankles black because I had no socks, we didn't have time to wipe it off, literally, between each take. So we'll do 3 or 4 takes. Do one where you do the outside of your ankle, so we won't see it. So if we do another take, it'll look like your ankle's completely. It's like, wait a minute, we don't have time to just come in, just wipe it off. And no, because if we go, we're going to go an hour overtime, and it's too expensive. And so we shot that scene in 5 minutes or less. And I'm trying to do the scene, but also, wait a minute, oh, I did the black here. No, I have to do it over here. And because we don't have time to wipe it off to start over and do a new take. It was freakishly rushed. But makes you think on your feet, you know.
And you get to wear a bow tie. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, what a joy.
Kevin, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the Sound of Young America. It was so great to have you.
It's great to be here.
My guest, Kevin Kline, is one of the stars of the film The Extra Man, which just premiered here at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I have been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart, the show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our music provided to us by Dan Wally. Nick White edits the show, and he produced and engineered our shows in Park City, Utah. Ben Harrison shot video, and in fact, you can see video of all of our Sundance interviews on our website at MaximumFun.org, absolutely 100% for free, thanks to Ben Harrison. Speaking of thanks, thanks to Eric Bright PR for providing us with a place to record while we were in Park City. If you have thoughts about the show, you can email me at Jesse, J-E-S-S-E, at MaximumFun.org. That's Jesse at MaximumFun.org. Or you can visit us online at MaximumFun.org, where you can download all of our past shows totally for free, and our other shows, like our comedy podcast, Jordan Jesse Go, or the Casper Hauser Comedy Podcast. We'll see you next time right here on The Sound of Young America.